This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
When Dorothy Kennett flew into Cape Town, South Africa, she saw a beautiful city and something else.
The largest shack village I've ever seen. It just goes on forever and ever, and it's cardboard and it's corrugated metal.
Kennett built a library and is creating more. Laura Kennedy has the story. Plus, how we make and recall memories is not a fixed process. ISU scholar Dawn McBride talks about false memories, and we'll have GLT's Grove. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Once a librarian, always a librarian. That's how it is for Dorothy Kennett, a media librarian who, after retiring from Illinois State University, found a second calling in her field, helping children miles from the Midwestern prairie. GLD's Laura Kennedy has more.
A simple invitation from her son set Dorothy Kennett on a midlife course change. Not too much of a change, because she was still working with books. Now, though, she does her work in South Africa, providing assistance literacy in the form of books, instructional materials, and computer training to underserved children as the engine behind Books for South Africa. It all started, says Kennett, in 2004. Her son Greg was the men's tennis coach at Illinois State University and was planning on taking the team to South Africa. And he invited his mother to go.
And I said, sure, that'd be lots of fun. And we flew into Cape Town and got in a little minibus. There were about 10 of us. And the first thing you see is the largest shack village I've ever seen. It just goes on forever and ever, and it's cardboard and it's corrugated metal.
So there was a great deal of poverty all
right
around.
Right there. And this was a brand new airport. It was in Cape Town. It's just a beautiful, beautiful town. But here it was, right there in the middle. There were kids in the dirt playing. This was the spark. I started seeing that kind of thing all over the country. And when I got home, I couldn't forget it.
But then where did you come up with the idea of starting libraries for the kids in South Africa?
I had applied to an orphanage, and I told them I'd come for a month, and I'd like to volunteer, and I got a no. Yes, I got turned down. So I thought about it, and so my first thought was, I asked about it, and it was because they wanted someone for 6 months. Because in this orphanage, when people came, the kids would say, what's your name and how long are you going to stay? And people were constantly coming and going with these children. And they'd say to them, I love you so much. I'll write you letters. You can come and visit me. And then they walk out the door and they wouldn't hear from them again. And so I really could understand it. So I was sitting at a meeting somewhere one day, and for some reason, this little light bulb went on and said, why don't you take them a library? And I go, why, yes, I'm a librarian. Why not? And I jumped up, ran home, got on the computer, applied again, and said, and I'll stay 6 months.
And I'm bringing some books with me.
Yeah, I did bring books. I also found books. People had given them everywhere. They were under beds, in closets, in the kitchen.
So you really had to go in and just get them organized.
Exactly.
And, you know, Dewey Decimal System and the whole,
exactly,
whole shebang.
Exactly.
What kind of books did you find when you went there?
Pretty much good books for their children. Sometimes really quality books. And then there were other times I would find books in French or workbooks all filled in already. So I did a lot of sorting, too. I found a warehouse that people at the orphanage who accepted gifts had piled books and books and books. And there were spiders, and there was dirt. And I got a wheelbarrow, and I filled the wheelbarrow, and I took it back to the place where I was staying and cleaned all the books, and then I wheeled them back.
I mean, this was just absolutely grassroots.
It was grassroots.
I want to do something, I'm going to go get a wheelbarrow and do it.
That's right.
You just really, literally got your hands dirty.
That's right.
Doing this.
Yeah.
So once you finished with this situation, you moved on to build other libraries.
Well, but I came home. I thought it was a one and done. I had no idea of continuing. So I came home, and maybe 6 months later, a lady that I recognized her voice and recognized her name called, and she said, "We want to know if we can have a library too."
So word had gotten around.
Yes. And yes, somebody had seen it. She had been at the orphanage.
They were impressed with your success.
Yes.
And they knew you could handle a wheelbarrow.
Yeah,
So they said, come on back and help us out. So where was this second location?
This was in a valley, in a rural valley. Suwamani is the name of it. I was there about 4 months, the second time. And the reason that I decided it would be a good thing to do is that I had taken these good notes on what I had done, how I had cataloged, what I purchased, all those things. I thought, I wonder if what I did, I've written enough down that I can duplicate it. So it was kind of a challenge. And again, I learned so much.
Dorothy, what was your biggest challenge in building these libraries?
Well, one challenge I had was at this particular place, we had a beautiful place to put it, nice building, but we didn't have any bookcases or shelves, and so we had to build our own. So I had gone back to the first library and taken pictures, and I had three young men in the area, and so I asked them if they would help me build these shelves, if I would buy the lumber, and I had an idea. And this young man, he had Midwest in his voice, the one from America. And I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "I'm from Northern Indiana." And I said, "Oh, it's too bad you're not from Illinois State." And he said, "I am."
He was a Redbird.
Yes.
Seriously, he was an ISU
yes.
student. This is the freakiest coincidence.
And he had just gotten his master's degree. So I made him chief of this building crew. And it was just, I heard them say to each other, they looked around and they said, "Did you ever build anything?" And they said, "No."
But they built those bookshelves.
They did. They were so proud. It was shelves for about 3,000 books.
How are you doing with regards to donations? Are you actively seeking monetary donations and books, or do you let serendipity really take a hand
this
there?
This year's been kind of serendipity, but I have gotten donations and enough to send these books. But it is something that even during the times when I'm not there, I want to be able to send books and or some funding to them. I am a not-for-profit, a 501(c). So that is a plus. I didn't do that for a long time, and I finally decided that was the fairest thing to do.
But you also have done mobile libraries,
yeah.
too. So why did you decide to go the mobile route?
These are not the usual mobile. They're not
like bookmobiles.
No. So I ran into a school principal somewhere, and we talked about possibilities. I ended up putting books in huge plastic, regular storage things. Put about 100 books in each one. I started out with, I think, 6. And this principal took charge of it. And we moved them from one school to another. And it, with mixed success, in a way, I found that the principals were afraid that they would get stolen or damaged, were more worried than they needed to be. And so they'd get the books in the tub, put them in a closet, and lock the door. You just have to appreciate where they're from and what they're doing, and you have to kind of move on from there. That, as far as I know, is still going.
Do you plan on building more?
It depends. My husband's health isn't just great right now, and that's one reason why I haven't gone back. I am sending books, probably yet this week. I have some books that that place called Books to Benefit donated quite a quantity of really, really nice books, and a couple of sets of Childcraft and some dictionary type things, as well as they love all books. And you would have to see this first library. I had set up an office in a kitchen in this place, and one day the kids were all in school. They were taken by bus to school in town. And she came up to the window and looked at me, and she said, "Dorothy, can I have a book?" And I handed it out the window. And she hugged it. She took the book and hugged it. You know, things like that were just priceless, absolutely priceless.
That's Dorothy Kennett, founder of Books for South Africa. To date, she's developed 5 complete libraries and given assistance to 4 more library programs in South Africa.
Dorothy Kennett has also established toy libraries to go with the books, helping kids find fun along with the learning. She talked with GLT's Laura Kennedy.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, offering independent living tailored to today's active seniors. Daily activities, housekeeping and laundry services, and nutritious chef-prepared meals. 1 and 2-bedroom apartments available. Complimentary planning guide at lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, how the appeal and objection process works on concealed carry in Illinois. The old saying is, memory is a faulty crutch. Illinois State University professor Dawn McBride knows that as well as anyone. She studies memory and the creation of false memories. Let's start the conversation with how memory works in the first place. Is it unchanging, or do we reconstruct it every time?
Pretty much the second. We reconstruct it every time. Memory works such that we store each of the pieces of an experience, in fact, in different areas of our brain, and then an important part called the hippocampus helps us put it all back together when we want to retrieve something, recall, remember something. And sometimes those pieces come back differently. They come back not at all, or they come back changed. So, yes, it's definitely a reconstructive process each time.
Why, then, do we have people who are reputed to have eidetic memories, you know, photographic memories or perfect memories if it's not actually photographic?
Right. There's no actual scientific evidence that there is such a thing as photographic memory, in that people take pictures of things and store them in their minds. What there is evidence of is people who have the ability to use mnemonic techniques in very expert ways. So, for example, there are people who compete in memory championships where they can memorize the order of cards in, say, 3 decks of cards that have been randomly mixed, and they can easily tell you how they do that, which is by creating elaborate images and pathways to connect the cards to and memorizing them that way very quickly. It's not because they're taking photographs of the cards and storing them.
And then for people who have otherwise really good memories, how is their way of accessing and reconstructing the data different from those of us who have less precise recall?
Well, it's probably not so much a matter of how they reconstruct it, it's how they store it in the first place. There are lots of ways that we can store information such that it's much more likely to be recalled later. Using, for example, imagery, connecting it with things we know, and creating things that are unusual that are going to stand out, give us lots of cues to help us retrieve something. So encoding it in a particular way is usually the best way to remember it. And then, of course, another best way to remember it is to practice remembering it. So the more you retrieve something, the more likely you are to then retrieve it again later in the future. And the more you practice that, it's like a muscle. The more you work it, the better it gets.
Is that good for specific items of recall, or is it just a general tool that will enable you to get better at all recall?
Well, it's usually seen more as a specific items for recall. So if you practice retrieving something, you're going to retrieve that particular information better.
The first 10,000 numbers of pi.
Right, right, exactly. But the more you practice using those kinds of techniques, the more likely you are to use them without even thinking about it. The more it's like a skill that you practice, and the more you are practicing encoding information in that particular way, or getting yourself in the practice of retrieving information, say when you have some downtime, just sitting around, you want to try to remember your vocabulary words for a test, then, you know, using that time to do that, when you get in practice for that, it will help you do it more again in the future.
There's a study, actually a number of studies, that show that chess masters, given several different chess positions to look at, can reconstruct them and tell you what piece went where with a high, high degree of accuracy. You know, the average club player, not so high. But if you randomize the pieces on the board and just have a cluster of pieces that is not within a structure of a game, the recall for the chess masters drops to maybe a little better than the average club player, but not that much higher.
Right.
What's going on there?
Well, the chess masters are using their expertise in chess and knowing different configurations of the board to more easily encode the information. So they're connecting it with things that they are experts at, things that they know very well. Whereas your average chess player may not know as many board configurations, they're not as easily able to encode that information, and so they're not going to retrieve it as easily.
So it's pattern recognition.
For the most part, in that case, yes.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Dawn McBride of Illinois State University about memories. What happens when patterns aren't true? What happens when you recall something and it's not what actually happened?
Well, in most cases, you're not even aware of it. Memories change all the time without us even realizing that they've been changed. They can change quite implicitly, unconsciously, just simply because we've thought about something differently, because someone has made a suggestion to us about an experience. Maybe they're relating their perspective on an experience, and without realizing it, it can change our own memory of the experience. So most false memories are cases where people don't even know that their memory is false.
For instance?
Well, to give you a for instance, I encounter situations often in talking to my husband where he says, "You never told me you were going to have a meeting late today and be home late today." And I say, "Yes, I did. I remember explicitly telling you that." And we may talk some more and reconstruct what actually happened. And I realize I only thought about telling him that I was going to be late that day and never actually did it. And so just thinking about it created sort of an event in my mind that I then later confused with an actual event that never really happened. But until we reconstructed what actually happened together, I believed that was an actual experience I'd had. It was a false memory that I thought was real.
Do people do that sort of false reconstruction when they're storytelling and they embellish or say something that adds to the drama of the story that over time shifts the nature of the story to something highly unlikely?
Oh, certainly. Studies have been done looking at how imagination even, just imagining performing actions, imagining something happening to you can influence memory. That is actually a way that many false memories have been created, by people simply imagining that something happened. And when you're telling a story, you're often reimagining the event, reimagining what occurred. And if you embellish, you are imagining those embellishments, and they can easily become part of your memory for the experience.
Now, you study something called the DeSerodiger-McDermott paradigm, a DRM, about false memory. Tell us how that works and what you're working on.
Mm-hmm. The DRM method is a very simple experimental technique to create very basic and benign false memories in research subjects. What we do is present lists of items that are thematically related to a word that is never shown or spoken to the participants. So, for example, if we present items like bed, slumber, blanket, dream, later, when we ask subjects to recall or recognize items that we've presented to them with high frequency, they'll think they have heard or seen the word sleep because it's very much thematically related to those items. But these are very benign false memories. It doesn't create any sort of bad experiences for our participants. But it does allow us to then change the way we create those lists, change the way they're presented, so that we can better understand how false memories are created through the way that our memory works on a natural, everyday basis.
If memory is a shaky set of ground, a swampy ground, how can we be sure of our memory enough to rely upon it?
Well, in most cases, our memory does work reasonably well. In fact, false memories are often not necessarily thought just of as memory errors, but a byproduct of our memories trying to help us. So if you think about the way that the DRM method I just described creates false memories by having us think that a word that's related to something we've already experienced was also experienced, that's actually our memory helping fill in perhaps pieces of missing items. If sleep had actually been shown and we didn't have a recollective experience of it, just simply filling in pieces of things that are related to what we did experience and we do recollect can actually help increase the accuracy of our memory. So it's sort of two sides of the same coin. Our memory is kind of trying to help us by filling in pieces of things that may not be complete in our memories based on how we know the world works, but also sometimes does that to excess and fills in pieces that are just not quite accurate. So in most cases, I think the core of our memory is correct. It's just that we sometimes get some details incorrect. And if we're careful not to engage in some of the techniques like too much fantasy and imagination, then we will probably not end up with too many experiences of memories that never actually happened.
It's not always benign, though. Sometimes false memories that are induced can be a real problem.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why the research has sort of investigated some of those techniques that we're concerned about might actually create those. So, for example, therapists using imagination and guided imagery to help people try to remember traumatic experiences. Well, that can be dangerous sometimes if, in fact, it leads to the creation of a false memory that is traumatic for that client. That's why the research is important to better understand exactly which of those techniques is problematic in terms of more likely to create false memories that are not benign for individuals.
So what's a problematic technique then?
Well, some of the things that I've been mentioning, asking if a therapist, for example, believes that someone is highly anxious because perhaps of a repressed memory from their childhood, asking them to simply imagine bad things that could have happened to them. I'm not a therapist, so I don't know exactly how those techniques work, but those kinds of things have been investigated in research to show that that sort of imagination technique can sometimes create false memories. And there have been cases where individuals have accused family members and other close friends of abuse from their childhood and so forth that have turned out to be false.
How about eyewitness testimony in criminal cases?
Mm-hmm. That's actually a very active area of research these days. Eyewitness memory is not perfect. And in fact, in some cases, even when eyewitnesses are quite confident in their memory is not accurate. Confidence is not always the best predictor of memory accuracy. In the last couple of decades, research has really advanced in that area. Questioning techniques of individuals who are witnesses or victims of crimes has slowly been changing. you know, officers are now aware, detectives are now aware of how suggestive questioning can change the answers they get from potential witnesses. And I think slowly some changes are being made that are helping prevent the kinds of false memories that might wrongfully convict someone of a crime.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about memories with Dawn McBride of Illinois State University. The amount of attention that a person is paying to a specific situation that may be up for later recall, say in a crime, how much does that affect what's going on in memory formation?
Well, it certainly can affect what is encoded. There are, for example, results from research showing that if one pays most attention to, say, a weapon, if they're a witness to a crime, then they might miss other details. In other cases, if you are paying close attention to all of the details, then you might actually improve your memory. So attention can both help and hinder depending on how it's used in a situation.
When someone is being called on to recall or to give a witness statement immediately afterwards, is that more reliable or less reliable than when they're called on to testify in court?
Well, you've got some things working for and some things working against initially. I don't know that there's a good set answer to that. I think it depends on how traumatized the person is. So the more traumatized they are, the more time might help their memory fill in gaps that the trauma is sort of blocking. But in other cases, if the person has experienced something that they have not been traumatized by, the short delay is actually going to help memory accuracy because, you know, forgetting obviously takes place pretty quickly. And if you wait too long, some of those details might be lost before they are able to go over what happened and recollect it to strengthen those memories. So it kind of depends on, I think, the situation that the person's in that's being questioned and asked to remember.
Is traumatic memory different from ordinary memory?
Some research has shown that it is. That's not specifically my area of expertise, but emotion certainly does influence our memories. Positive emotions, negative emotions can both influence memory in different ways. Some research has shown, for example, that you're more likely to have false memories in some of the simple paradigms, experimental paradigms that have been used, if you're in a positive mood than if you're in a negative mood.
Why?
Well, because when you're in a negative mood, you're more likely to focus on details. And if you focus on the details, you're more likely to remember, for example, exactly which words were presented to you in, say, the DRM paradigm and be able to reject sleep as an item that was presented. But if you're in a positive mood, you're more likely to be making sort of relational or notice relations between items, between information. And so you're more likely to think, oh, well, sleep's related to those items, so it must be one that I saw on the list. And that's generally what the research has shown.
So the old joke about I'm not a pessimist, I'm a realist, it has some truth to it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Maybe you can help me here. Over the last couple of years, my schedule has gotten so busy, and maybe I'm just older than I used to be, but I am having more trouble and more fear of not remembering my to-do list, the things I have on a daily basis. Now, I've compensated with computer software, but I still worry more than I used to. And a lot of the time, my computer software gives me surprises where it did not seem to do that, you know, mm-hmm. 10 years ago. What's going on there?
Well, there are a couple of things. What you're talking about here is your prospective memory, so trying to remember things you need to do in the future. And the computer programs will help. The schedules, the post-it notes, all of those kinds of things will help. As we get older, we do tend to fear more that those kinds of things are going to fail us. That's the most common memory failure reported by older adults. And in fact, the busier we are, the more likely we are to miss some of those things we need to remember to do. But the good news is that a lot of the research shows that the older we get, the better we get at constructing our environments to help us remember. So in fact, when older adults are asked to do tasks in research where they have to remember to do something in the future, like mail a postcard or call a researcher or send a text message, they actually tend to do better than younger adults, partly because they are able to set up their environment so that they remember. They're more motivated sometimes to do those kinds of tasks. They tend to show pretty good abilities in that, even though if you ask them, they'll say, I tend to be pretty bad at those kinds of things, in their own sort of ideas of their memory.
Dawn McBride is a professor at Illinois State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a poverty simulation. Illinois was the last state in the U.S. to pass a law allowing people to carry a concealed gun. That was back in 2013. The system legislators came up with is unique in the country. It's designed to get concealed carry licenses quickly to those who qualify while keeping them from dangerous people. But some law enforcement bodies and gun owners say it's failing at both of those things. IPR's Miles Bryan has the story.
Maureen Malloy is a criminal analyst for the Cook County Sheriff's Office. Her job is to try and stop gun violence before it happens. Every workday, she combs a database of concealed carry license applications, looking for red flags. On a recent weekday afternoon, she pulled up the arrest history of one Cook County applicant.
So that one's okay. It was just driving on a suspended license. Here is a UUW, unlawful use of a weapon. That's what we are actually objecting to.
This guy Malloy's talking about, he's been arrested before, but he doesn't have any felony convictions. He meets the initial requirements the Illinois State Police have for applying for a concealed carry license. So the sheriff's office can object to him, but the actual decision is made by a special board called the Concealed Carry Licensing Review Board. And that's where they run into a wall. The sheriff's office says last year, the board threw out its objections 90% of the time.
It is frustrating. It's kind of out of our hands then, even though we objected to it.
The sheriff's office says last year, for example, it objected to a documented gang member who had previously been arrested for robbery. He still got the license. Most other states handle concealed carry one of two ways, shall issue or may issue. In shall issue states, if you meet the requirements, the state shall issue you a license. While in may-issue states, law enforcement generally gets the final say. Cara Smith with the Cook County Sheriff's Office says Illinois' unique system of objecting means they spend a lot of time and money for little success.
We certainly have examples of people who we felt very strongly they shouldn't have an application. They have a history of domestic violence. They have a history of orders of protection. And yet they're receiving a license.
The Chicago Police Department says they're having the same problems. Last year, 68% of their objections were thrown out by the board. We filed Freedom of Information Act requests to get basic data about concealed carry in Illinois, but they were all denied. The board does send a monthly report to the governor's office. We crunched the report's numbers and found that the board threw out 82% of all law enforcement objections statewide last year. After asking the board about that and waiting months for an answer, a board spokesman said that's not right because they count some objections more than once. But the spokesman couldn't provide any clarity. That means the only public data on the concealed carry system in Illinois is useless. A spokeswoman for the governor's office said in a statement that those reports were, quote, clearly not reflective of the board's work, and that the governor's office was willing to work with the board to, quote, address those flaws. Now, at this point, you might think that it's just easy to get a concealed carry license in Illinois, which could please some gun rights advocates. But lots of Cook County gun owners are frustrated with the system, too. People like Eric Gatewood, who works serving eviction papers and other legal documents, delivering news that often makes people very unhappy.
Some people have been chased with bats. One guy pulled a knife out on a person that worked with me, and he ran away. I don't want to encounter nothing like that.
Gatewood applied for his concealed carry license in January of 2016. The next month, he got a letter stating he had been objected to. He says he didn't know why, but figured it'd get cleared up quickly. He was wrong.
For 13 months, I'm going to the mailbox. When the mail comes, I'm thinking it's in there today, it's today, it's today, and it's not. So it was very frustrating.
Gatewood says every day for those 13 months that he was out serving eviction papers or divorce notices, seeing people at their most volatile, he wished he could have been carrying his gun. He would have felt safer. WBEZ spoke with other people who waited over 2 years to hear about their license applications. A spokesperson for the group Illinois Carry says there are hundreds of people who have waited over a year.
Well, after they sent me 13 letters, I wish they'd call me one time or at least email me back and saying something, but I got nothing from them. I felt at that time my constitutional rights was violated.
Gatewood never got official word of why he was objected to. He says in desperation, he eventually called his local state senator for help. His concealed carry license finally arrived in the mail soon after that.
We were, pardon the pun, you know, on negotiating this under the gun.
Kwame Raoul is Eric Gatewood's state senator. He's currently running for state attorney general. Raoul also helped come up with Illinois' concealed carry law back in 2013. The state used to have a ban on concealed carry, but in late 2012, a federal court threw it out and gave legislators 6 months to come up with a law.
The implication of that is if you don't do it within 180 days, basically you have the Wild Wild West where people have like the right to carry with no definition.
Raoul defends the legislation's goals of balancing the rights of gun owners with the concerns of law enforcement. But when presented with the frustrations of gun owners like Gatewood, and with the high rate that the board is throwing out Chicago area objections, he says it's time for another look.
If we got everything perfectly right in the legislature the first time, there would be probably no need for a legislature by now. so we're constantly in the process of reform.
Changing Illinois' concealed carry system would require new legislation. And after last month's massacre at a school in Florida, a lot of gun bills have started to move through Springfield. But those bills are still divisive, and a change to concealed carry probably would be too. Still, for gun owners and law enforcement, one thing is clear. The system needs to change. I'm Miles Bryan reporting.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. About 100 teachers and support staff recently gathered in a junior high school in central Illinois to take on the roles of people living in poverty. It's part of a poverty simulation used by schools across the country that's supposed to challenge stereotypes. But as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, some say it takes more than a one-time simulation to change attitudes and behaviors.
I just got robbed by a drug lord. They're pushing me to sell their drugs, and I told them no, and they're threatening my family, and they took my Social Security card.
We're inside a school gym in Mahomet, a small town in east central Illinois. The median income here is almost $100,000, and the town is majority white. The staff have to make ends meet over the course of a month, but really it's a two-hour simulation. The ones role-playing single moms have baby dolls strapped to their chests. I'm talking to Natalie Back, a 7th grade history teacher. She was just speaking in character as a 52-year-old Latino man with disabilities. I asked Back to break character for a moment.
Does this feel like a game to you?
No, honestly, I'm feeling stressed. I mean, obviously it's not reality.
It may not feel like a game to Back, but Susan Roll says it certainly looked like one the first time she tried it. Roll is a social work professor at California State University in Chico. She says she and her colleague were super excited about the simulation, but the first time they tried it with their students, it didn't go so well.
We were standing there and we were watching this go down, and we thought, people are playing poverty. Like, this doesn't feel right. And students were sort of silly about it and laughing and, oh, isn't this funny? And, oh, I beat you and I have more money than you. And, oh, there's the drug lord and he might try to steal from you. And it felt very uncomfortable.
Inspired by their discomfort, Roll and her colleagues studied the simulation's long-term effectiveness. They found that without the proper context and critical thinking, the simulation could do more harm than good. Take Kim Senor's experience with the simulation. Senor works as a liaison between the Springfield School District and families in that community. Springfield is about an hour drive west of Mahomet and has a median income that's half that of the small town. Senor says the simulation felt very real to her.
It's a lot, and it made me sick. Literally, in the simulation, I passed out.
And that's because it mirrored her previous experience living in poverty after she left an abusive marriage.
Couldn't find a job to get up on my feet. I had these children, and my child support was like $250 a month. And so it was a nightmare.
Senor says the simulation helped her relate on a deeper level to the low-income families she works with. But not everybody comes out of the simulation feeling like that, especially without her experience. Senor says some of the educators she knows, well,
they were very cocky about, well, we can survive this. And so that's what I saw. I was like, they really don't know. They just figured out a piece of it. It didn't offer any empathy or sympathy toward any families. They were just, well, if we could figure it out in 3 hours, surely somebody can figure it out that's been in it for years and years, which is not the case.
The group that sells the poverty simulation admits it's not perfect. It's a nonprofit called the Missouri Community Action Network, MCAN for short. They say the simulation is supposed to start a conversation that breaks down stereotypes and drives civic action. But they say it can backfire if it's not facilitated correctly. Roll, the professor at California State, says she made the simulation work for her by adding local data and stories to show how poverty affects the university community. I asked her if she still using the simulation.
We're not.
And why did you?
I didn't feel like after a while I was getting my bang for my buck.
She says she now uses other strategies to get her students engaged with poverty, including getting out of the classroom and into their local community. Senor, the Springfield Public Schools employee, thinks that approach could work for school teachers too.
Without a shadow of a doubt, we need more teachers going out and doing home visits and actually seeing what's going on.
Senor still thinks the poverty simulation is valuable, but
it is not enough.
I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a journalism collaboration focusing on expanding coverage of education, state politics, health, and the environment. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Potato skins, coffee grounds, plant material, dryer lint, these things and more can go into your compost bin, creating rich organic material for the health of your garden. And just as there are many items that can be composted, there is lots of different bins you can create. Patrick Murphy has some suggestions on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Nothing feeds a garden better than compost from your own backyard. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice. From our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hi, happy spring.
Well, we're happy that it is spring, and today on GLT's Grow, we're going to make sure we have a fruitful spring. We're going to create a compost bin so we can start basically creating our own compost.
Creating compost is a worthy exercise for any gardener.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a chuckle out of compost because when you talk to somebody that you think is or they claim to be a gardener, compost, I think, is one of many topics that can reveal the truthfulness about somebody's level of dedication.
Okay.
And if you're going to get excited about turning garbage into dirt, you've convinced me that you are passionate about gardening.
All right.
And not that I'm the only judge, but I've heard that spoken by other people whose opinions I admire. Compost is new and it's old. It's a tried and true practice. the new site of compost that I, this is me trying to convince you and everyone that I'm geeked out on gardening. There are actually compostable garbage bags made for sale nowadays.
Oh, that's fabulous.
It is fabulous because before that, you had the honey pot, which is the little sealable container, clay, whatever it is that you put the eggshells, the coffee grounds, whatever you produce in the household. Dryer lint. Remember we talked about dryer lint?
Yes.
Good thing to add some body and fiber to your compost.
Mm-hmm.
But this is huge. So if you're a restaurateur, all of a sudden you have an ability to compost food scraps because the bag that they go in breaks down too. So I don't want to spend the whole time talking about it, but this is
huge. But that's
a
great – so if you're actually not somebody who's handy with a hammer and saw or what have you, that's a way to have your own compost bin. You've just – and you got a big family? Well, there you go. You've got that garbage bag.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to talk, too, about the different kinds of compost configurations. So, yeah, the bag is the latest craze.
Right.
But we also have compost tumblers. They're very popular, and they've been around for a long time.
And they're literally – it's like you're playing bingo. You put the stuff in there, you close the lid, and then you turn a crank, and it goes around and around.
Right. That's right. And they're great for you know, I say your California garden. So if you got the little house in a metropolitan area and you got the little gangway garden on the side, you're not producing a whole lot of organic waste, but enough to keep that tumbler full in addition to your toenails and your coffee grounds.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And then there's also, they're just as popular as the tumblers, there's the bottomless bins. They're usually green in color, like hunter green in color. And they rest on the ground.
And they literally do not have a bottom.
They don't have a bottom typically, so, or they'll have a bottom that allows the moisture to weep or drip out. But they can be moved around. They have about the same capacity as the tumblers. You can buy these in little kits. You know, they're like the size of a dog crate once you put it together. And whether it's a tumbler, a bottomless bin, we're going to talk about some others, wire bins. You should put your compost where you think you're going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Because wherever you compost, the pile is going to shrink over time. It's going to be much smaller than the device that you're collecting it in, the volume of that device. Or if you're a gardener that's got some space, you might have your compost just a loose pile on the ground. And that works, too.
Oh, great. You know, that's very low maintenance.
The only little caveat between all the different kinds of composting is that if you live in an extremely wet or dry condition, you might need a cover.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. And this week, we're talking about compost bins. You said you could make them out of wire?
Yeah, wire bins that you can buy the kits that way, a three-wall or a four-wall, so a triangle, a square.
So it's open air.
It's open air.
Is that important that it be open air?
It is, because there's some materials are breaking down there. You get some thermal energy from that, and you need some of that to be able to escape along with some of the gases.
Is it kind of stinky?
Well, early compost might have a smell to it, but when it no longer smells like what it originally was, you know your compost is just about ready.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, because I wanted to tell everybody that. You know your compost is ready because it will smell like, feel like, and look like dirt.
Yay!
That's when it's ready. That could take 6 weeks. It could take 2 years.
It really
depends on what you're composting, where it's at, and how much there is.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we talked about the tumblers, bottomless bins, wireless bins. Really popular now because repurposing is popular is pallet bins or pallet corrals made of 2, 3, 4 pallets all kind of connected together.
Great.
And, you know, pallets have the baffles in between the little planks of wood.
So that lets some air through.
And also if it's rainy, you know, allows some of that moisture to escape. Some of it's absorbed by the wood. Some of it just passes through the gaps in evaporation and evapotranspiration. So they work great. I mentioned covering compost. There's lots of varying points of view on that. Covering compost can help kind of trap that thermal energy. But composting will work inside the pile without a cover on it. I just wanted to make that comment. If you live in Seattle,
all right,
or you live in Tucson, you might have to put a cover over there to create consistency of one temperature. instead of letting it bake and then cool down or get cold and warm back up, compost works best and breaks down the best when it's the consistent temperature.
Great tip.
You can monitor your compost if you need to.
Oh, should I put like a camera on it?
Yeah, right.
It's compost cam.
A timer, you know. It's time, ding, ding, ding. It's time to go out and turn your compost. So that brings us back to the tumblers. Turning compost mixes in the older broken down debris with the newer stuff.
And that will hasten the breaking down of the newer stuff.
That's right. But if you're tumbling it too often, you kind of interfere in some of that.
Ah.
So you're exposing some of that mold and things that help break it down. It likes the dark and the dank in the middle of the pile. But if you're turning it too frequently, it's exposed to the air and it's going to break down slower.
So what's a good timing?
I don't know for sure.
Ooh, that's tricky.
I know. And it falls in that 6 week to 2 year time period.
Well, that's kind of a long span there.
It sure is. It sure is. But if it's the context in which you're collecting compost. So
okay.
It's the household. You're going to turn it maybe on the change of the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a landscaper or a farmer or somebody that's a land manager that has large piles of compost, you may never turn them.
Amazing.
And you might turn them when you go to get some of that compost and that bucket goes into the pile.
Mm-hmm.
You pull the good stuff off the bottom and the older stuff mixes with what's left behind and it continues to break down.
Just make sure that pile doesn't get taller than you are because you don't want to get buried under an avalanche of compost.
Yeah, because then you can't handle that with a wheelbarrow.
Mm-hmm.
You could. That's a lifetime supply of compost. So
yeah.
if you're dealing with compost piles of that size, I hope you're a landscape contractor
uh-huh.
or a professional gardener of some kind. But composting is fantastic, and there's almost everything that's left over in your kitchen can disappear into a honey pot and then make it out to your compost bin. You got to keep the meats and stuff out of there and meat fats because that's what attracts the varmints to forage in your compost.
So just potato skins and things like that, and you'll be in good shape.
That's right.
All right. Great. Great advice there, Murph. Thank you so much. Next week on GLT's Grow, Bill in Memphis, Tennessee needs advice on how to be an absentee gardener. So we'll be tackling that next week.
Can do.
On Grow. Now, if you've got a gardening question or problem that you would like Murph to take on, go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form and send it along to us, and feel free to include a photo of your gardening issue. Submit your gardening questions right now at wglt.org/grow.
You can subscribe to the GLT Grow podcast on Apple products, Stitcher, or NPR One. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews with help today from Laura Kennedy. Find the full show podcast at wglt.org or, again, Stitcher, NPR One, or Apple Podcasts. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.